Bree Williams, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So talk about your organization, PEERS. What is it and how does it work?
So PEERS is an acronym. It stands for Peers Envisioning and Engaging in Recovery Services. We're a nonprofit organization and we're consumer run. What that means is that pretty much 100% of our staff identify as having lived experience in the mental health field or system. And we provide a wide range of services that are free or low cost to community. We really believe in self-determination and choice. So in the mental health world, we don't really use what's called a medical model. We really believe that people should have, you know, just many places and sources to go to achieve wellness for themselves. So,
and that was my next question. Like, how is this different than the traditional client therapist model?
It's different in the way that, so we don't do any direct clinical services. We do nothing clinical, actually. All of our services are quote-unquote wellness-based. We use a lot of what's called evidence-based practices, which is a model that people use in like the non-traditional medical model world, where they believe that clients or people or consumers should have a choice as to what they use. They're not, so it's not like a therapist is giving a person a plan or is prescribing them medication that they have to use. It's more so the person, you know, comes in. First, they have the free choice to come in, so they're not mandated. They don't have to come to any of our programmings or groups, but if they do come into our doors, they're welcome, they're welcome and free to choose, you know, whatever programs best fits their needs. And in fact, a lot of our programs, we try to contract with community members. For example, we have something called Lift Every Voice and Speak, which is a speakers bureau. And we contract with people who are consumers who have lived experience in mental health. And we pay them to train them and to go out and to tell their stories in the community. So we're very, very different. None of us are therapists. All of us are providers, though. So we have training. We have years of experience in mental health. But it's not like a direct service where we meet with individuals one-on-one and prescribe them medications. It's more so they come into our offices to choose services to use for themselves that best work for themselves.
How do you address like a psychosis or someone who's hallucinating?
So all of our services are kind of like drop-in, but if a person comes in and they're in what we would call a mental health crisis, we do have people who are trained. There are things like 5150, de-escalation training. There are various trainings. There's something called ECPR, which stands for emotional CPR, and that's actually one of the programs that we offer to community. There's another tool called Wellness Recovery Action Planning. So we have various tools that we use to engage with people in the moment if they're experiencing a mental health crisis. But usually whoever walks in, like say if they walk in and they're maybe mumbling something to themselves, we just welcome them. We don't turn anybody away. One thing that I think is important to know about mental health is that people usually know what they need for themselves. And one thing that I like to talk about too, like, mental health is stigmatized because when we look at or when we think of the term mental health, you think of that person in the street that's talking to themselves, pushing the cart, or you'll think about a movie where you see people rocking and, you know, just kind of out of it. But those are actually like, that's not mental health. That's what I would call mental illness. Mental health is the absence of mental illness. And if a person is not well, you know, they may be doing things like using substances that are only going to highlight their senses of being unwell. You know what I mean? So it's unfortunate because a lot of the times, like, I'm a person who deals with mental health challenges, you know, but the world wouldn't see me as that. So it's just important to recognize that people show up in many different ways. And we have multiple trainings to support people in the moment when they're dealing with crisis.
What would you say the common areas that most people that you deal with are grappling with, the common mental health concerns?
It's really stuff that I think all of us deal with, like, you know, depression, anxiety, so many things, social phobia. There are various things that people deal with, and a lot of our staff actually deal with these same type of challenges. So those are some of the main issues that I assume that people are dealing with, because we also don't ask. what I love about peers is that it's so empowering. And it's like, if you just show up and you're here for a group, just come on in. You know, we're not going to ask you what your thing is. But those are some of the common mental health challenges that folks are dealing with.
And so when someone comes in and they have an anxiety issue, what's the first step? What do you do with this person?
The first step would really just to be with them. You know, like if a person came in and they were in the moment experiencing a mental health crisis, with our ECPR training, the first thing that we're taught to do is just to kind of be with them. Like, say if they come in and, you know, they come and they sit down and they're a little anxious, you know, we probably just come in there and sit with them, you know, and just kind of wait a little second and vibe with them, and then ask, you know, hey, can I get you anything? And they'll let us know. People are aware enough to say what they need and know what they need.
I guess mainly what I was getting at is it a one-to-one counseling situation, or you do group counseling when people come in for mental health issues?
It's one-on-one. So let's see, how can I describe? So we have an array of programs and groups and trainings. So since we're not directing, we don't provide direct clinical services, none of our programs do like one-on-one sit down and a person says, hey, I'm feeling anxious about this, you know, and then we counsel them. It's not counseling, it's more so like the Speakers Bureau meets twice a month, so that group meets twice a month and they come and they talk about, you know, whatever public speaking needs to happen. We have a TAE group. They did one-on-one mentoring, you know, as needed. We have our ongoing RAP groups, which is a support group. So like in a RAP group, there are two facilitators and there are maybe like, you know, 5 to 12 participants. And in that group, somebody may say, hey, well, I'm really feeling, you know, whatever, whatever. And in the group, we'll talk it through. But there isn't anything that's like one-on-one direct clinical services.
And you mentioned TAY, T-A-Y. Talk about that acronym, and that's your youth program and what it is you all do in TAY.
TAE stands for Transition Age Youth, and we serve young people between the ages of 16 to 24 years of age. Transition Age Youth represent people who have lived experience in mental health, foster care, and/or juvenile justice systems. And that's a program where we welcome young people who maybe are leaders in the community or want to be leaders in the community. We provide them with life and job skills training. They meet with other young people. They go out and facilitate what we call wellness workshops to other young people or other TAE-serving organizations. We train them. Wellness Recovery Action Planning is a facilitation training, so we also train them in RAP, in any other trainings that we have access to at the time. And we do a lot of partnerships with various organizations, and that's the gist of it.
What would you say the issues that the youth are dealing with?
The transition age youth population is such a unique population because they're dealing with like growing up and the stressors that comes with already. But then being a young person who may have a mental health diagnosis or come from the foster care system or come from the juvenile justice system, they're just dealing with how do you navigate life. So there's some depression there's some anxiety, there may be some homelessness, there may be some child care needs, there may be some food needs, employment needs, educational needs, so many things that young people need. And so with our program, we try to support them as best we can to gain access to those resources and also just learn how to navigate so that they can find it themselves, you know, when their term with us is up.
And are you seeing any examples of racially induced stress from discrimination?
Oh, yeah. In a lot of my work, that's one of the biggest things that I highlight as a mental health challenge for African-American people is racism or classism or, you know, any of the isms. Young people of color deal with all the rest of the stuff that the rest of the youth deal with, and then they deal with being discriminated against. They deal with going to jail instead of having adequate mental health services for needs they have. You know, if they're hungry and they steal, they get taken in jail instead of somebody saying, hey, you know, what's going on with you? Where do you come from? How can I support you? So there are so many barriers and pitfalls that African-American youth and other youth, Latino youth, youth of color, fall through based on just not having access, you know, and not having a system that's designed to support them because, you know, of the structure of America.
Do you have any personal stories that you can share of someone who's maybe gone through the program and went from having anxiety to to being a well-adjusted member of society?
I can think of a few, but I guess I would most likely like to say myself. I started my work as a young person being diagnosed and just not knowing where to go, where to turn. And then being connected with my mom to the behavioral healthcare system, and they had what we called a TAE board at the time. And young people could go to these board meetings and they would get like a stipend, and they would give their insight about how it was to be a young person receiving services from the system. And I would go to these meetings and I really enjoyed it. And I found that at the time I was also going to become a mother. And so because we got stipends, because I enjoyed the work, I really advocated for that TAE board to be a long-term employment program. And it became that. So
around
I'm a founder.
What year was this?
This was 2011. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and I still do. I'm a young person who was diagnosed with anxiety, depression, and social phobia. And so I still deal with these things, but through being connected to so many young people, having adults who were so supportive and told me that mental health is a thing, but it's not your destiny. In fact, that was a slogan that we had, was diagnosis does not mean destiny. And so we were so empowered and we were told so much about ourselves that the mental health piece was such a small piece of who we were. And I was able to just actualize my talents and get a full-time job, you know, and I've been working with peers since the TAE program has been founded. But there are many stories like that. I remember actually a good friend of mine came to the program. This individual would never, like, barely speak, but we welcomed this person because that's just what it was. But this person, you know, barely spoke. They would come to the meetings. They would be there. We would have conferences and workshops. They would still be there but not speak. And then, you know, over time, they began speaking up, and to the point where they were presenting at conferences and even got a job at the county. So it's just a great program.
Talk about the Alameda County Everyone Counts campaign. We'll be focusing for 2018 through 2020 on providing services to and reducing mental health stigma for African Americans. Can you talk about the Alameda County Everyone Counts campaign?
Yeah, so Everyone Counts campaign, this is probably our sixth or seventh year running. So every 2 years, we focus on a different underserved population. We've done projects with the Chinese American community and the Latino American community, and now we're doing African American community. And the goal of this project is to just highlight where the resources, where the trainings, where the programs that provide services that are just for this population, because there is a huge lack and need for services, especially, you know, culturally responsive mental health services for African American people.
Is there anywhere now that people can get information? Any websites?
Well, the project hasn't started yet. So, if folks were looking for resources that were specifically for African American people, I would encourage them to go to the Alameda County's Behavioral Healthcare website, which is acbhcs.org. And they have all of this African American work stems from a African American utilization project that was done in 2011. And so the county has been working to, you know, since then to really figure out how do we best serve this population based on recommendations that came out of that utilization study.
I haven't heard of this, the African American utilization study. What was that?
It was an effort by the county to figure out how do we best serve African Americans. So what they were finding was African American people were somehow they found that African American people get the most services, right? But they're not getting better. And what we found is that our services are jail. Our services are, you know, psych wards. Our services are things that you would not put a person who was experiencing mental health challenges. You wouldn't first send them there, but they were in jail getting mental health care, or they're in jail getting, you know, I like to say they're getting doped up on meds because, you know, how much care is a person really receiving in jail, especially when I know the history of jail. I mean, a lot of us know that, you know, jail is slavery. So how much care and attention are they really getting in prison? And even like in juvenile hall, I did a 10-week pilot at juvenile hall with young kids trying to teach them just awareness of African history and self, and also how to navigate the prison industrial system. And they had so many free services for these children, free dental, free optometry, so many services that they could get for free, but they're in kid jail. So a lot of our services for African-American people, they deem them as actual services, but To get them, you have to be a prisoner or just totally unwell.
And of the things that people can do when they come to you and they get peer services, do you also teach how people can handle mental health issues themselves, like self-care?
Yes. One of the programs that Peers was founded on is called WRAP. It stands for Wellness Recovery Action Planning. And that's an evidence-based practice, and it's a really, really cool tool that people use to manage wellness. The first thing that you do is go through like an 8 or 10 week group process, and you have 2 certified WRAP facilitators who give you this tool called WRAP, and it takes you through, you identify these various things for yourself. So first you identify 5 key concepts, which are hope, personal responsibility, education, self-advocacy, and support. You identify how do these things show up in your life or what do these things mean to you? And we use that as a foundation of what we call our recovery journey. So whenever, you know, whenever something happens in life, you can remember your hope is that, you know, like my hope is that I'll always get better. So even if I'm in a rut of depression and it's really dark and I feel hopeless, I can remember my hope. And we write these down in a booklet so that sometimes, you know, you forget things. So it's good to have it written down. So you identify these things for yourself. My favorite part of it is the wellness tools. We define wellness tools as things that are safe, simple, and free, or inexpensive and non-invasive that you do to feel well. So it could be anything like reading a book, riding a bike, taking a run, eating a nice fruit salad, talking to a supporter. You know, anything that you do that makes you feel well, but it doesn't cost a lot and it's not too hard to do. Like, you don't have to drive 10 miles somewhere and push a button and wait. You know, like, it's not something that's super hard to do. Another part that's super helpful from WRAP is something called the triggers. So we identify what are our triggers, and we call triggers things that are external events or circumstances. And when they happen, they make us feel, you know, stressed or uncomfortable. So it could be anything like a loud voice or a loud tone or a scent or, you know, the anniversary of a traumatic event. So people define whatever these triggers look like for them. And then they create action plans. So they use their wellness tools really to address their triggers. So, you know, like a huge trigger of mine is like traffic. Like, I don't like being in traffic. It reminds me that I'm not in control. You know, it reminds me of times in my life that I wasn't in control. And so I use an action plan or a wellness tool. My action plan and my wellness tool is music. I can turn up my music as loud as I want. I can groove in the car, you know, while I'm driving, and then I can control the situation then. So that's an example of what we really push and believe in for self-care is our WRAP. And that's a program that we offer. It's a free group every Friday from 1:30 to 3:30 at Peers.
And who is eligible for the WRAP program?
Anybody and everybody. Anybody can come to WRAP.
And although mental health kind of carries a social stigma, do you find that self-care does in our society too, where people are take pride in constantly being busy or multitasking? How do you see that?
I think self-care, I think that people are more getting into the idea of why it's so important. Especially like in our advocacy work of mental health, you know, so many people are experiencing mental health feeling or diagnosis in their lifetime. So self-care, we really want to normalize the idea of self-care. And I think that the more that we talk about self-care, we can get away from the word mental health and just call it self-care, like if that makes sense. Because mental health is so stigmatized, self-care is just something that people need to do. You know, self-care is, you know, getting rid of toxic people in your life or just taking a drink of water. So I really love this idea of like, you know, I have to get some self-care. Like, I see it a lot on social media. I see a lot of people pushing for it. I'm hearing it just in regular conversations about people getting self-care. The only thing that I hope for that I don't see yet is like a lot of people of color getting into it. Because I feel like a lot of us are, it's actually a lot of studies around what trauma does to the body and the brain. And because a lot of us deal with so much trauma, we're constantly in fight or flight mode. So we're constantly looking, you know, worried about something or super hypervigilant and not really taking a moment to just pause and breathe. So I really want to see more of more self-care in the African-American community.
Do you see that changing?
I do. My mom is a healer. I'm seeing so many healers, or, you know, what I would call self-care practitioners. Like meditation is a self-care method. Just exercise, you know, dance. Like I so push for people to like get into some African drumming or get into some African dance, because that's self-care, allowing your body to move in a cultural way. There are studies done about how the drum is calming, and it works so good for people who deal with anxiety. So I'm seeing a lot of us push for this. I'm seeing a lot of people practicing it more, and I'm seeing a lot of people sharing it more with families. That's really how we get stuff. That's how we change culture in our community, right? It's word of mouth. So it's about doing it and talking about it, and hopefully somebody else does it. They talk about it, and it just becomes an epidemic.
What's the breakdown in gender that you have? Do you have a lot of men or males coming in to the program?
It's probably more women, but we do have men who come in.
And is there any type of special outreach to reach out to young men?
No, that's a great question. We should probably look into doing a little more focused outreach to get some more young men in, and just men in general. We do have a partner organization called Black Men Speak that's full of men, and they don't just focus on Black men. They allow any men of color to come in, and they also provide just a safe space for men to talk about like life, what's happened to them, how did they get better, and then how do they, you know, then they go out into the community and tell other young men, you know, this is what I use to help myself, and you can get better too. So we do have a program that's just full of men.
When it comes to the Black Men Speak thing, I've heard Black boys are overdiagnosed with ADD. Do you have a particular approach to Black boys when you work with them versus Black girls?
I don't do any direct clinical work, but I will say this. So in mental health, they don't really study how medications affect Black people. Like we're all the same biologically human beings, but because of our melanin and different things, you know, we have a different experience. And because there are no studies done, our children are overdiagnosed and misdiagnosed. Not even our children. People in general, Black people in general, are either overdiagnosed, misdiagnosed, or just mistreated from the system. So I think it's important to really pay attention to the lifestyle of the child. What is the lived experience of the child? And then to treat them according to that. Never a diagnosis, because they don't, you know, I say they as in the system, you know, they don't love us. They don't really take time to really address the real need, you know, of the individual. So I just take time, you know, with every person that comes into my door, whoever crosses my path, whoever calls me and says, hey, I need this for my kid. You know, I want to get enough background information to, you know, give them the best resource, because it's so much misdiagnoses in the community, and you have to just do away with whatever the label is and look at the person and the person's experience, and then go according to that.
And how can people contact your organization?
We're on peersnet.org. They can find us online. They can find us on Facebook and Instagram, Peers. And, yeah.
Well, Bree Williams, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Bree Williams, Program Director of Peers, a nonprofit promoting peer-based wellness strategies and offering community-based mental health programs.